Phil Tiger. Slacker Podcast. Hello, Slackers. I hope you're good. I hope you're well. I hope that your kitchens are fully stocked of tasty, healthy, beautiful food, and that your shirts are crease-free and look incredible. It's been 7 days since the last time we hung out. That is to all of the ones that who've already subscribed. If you are fresh to this and you're landing on it today, hello to you. Hope you're good. And this is your first run out with us here at Slacker FC, so stick on a jersey and enjoy these podcasts. Also, if you've just landed on this Declan McKenna podcast, there are three other episodes for you to go and listen to. The very first one was Manic Street Preachers. Second one was Wolf Alice, third one's Bastille, and obviously you know the fourth one because you're here right now. My name is Phil Taggart. It's actually Philip Taggart. I've dropped the I and the P. Does that make it a stage name? It's not exactly like Elton John, is it? Or like ASAP Rocky? Okay, yeah, it does. It makes it a really shit stage name. How about that? I'm a DJ and broadcaster on BBC Radio 1. If you like the podcast, you might like my Sunday night show on BBC Radio 1, 7 p.m. It's the one that is designed to kill off anxiety and fear. 100% works 100% of the time, I think. It is called The Chillest Show, and it's on Sunday night, 7 p.m. Come say hello. And yeah, back to the podcast. The whole idea of the Slacker podcast is to get artists on, you know, artists I really, really, really want to talk to, and get a really early demo from them, from when they were just starting out, from when they were little cherubs, when they were little beans. And sort of get an idea of who they were at that time from the early demo, and kind of how they developed over time into who they would become and who was it was that I would be interviewing that particular week. And so far, so good. Thank you so much as well to everybody who's been rating and reviewing the podcast. It's been lovely. It really has. The first few podcasts have done really well, and that is 100% down to you guys for rating, reviewing, and subscribing. It hit number one last week, it hit number one the week beforehand, and it's been in the top five for the 3 weeks that it's been in existence on the music charts podcast bit on Apple. So if you haven't already and you're idle right now and you're listening to this and you're like, oh, I've got a bit of Wi-Fi, I know what I can do. It would mean a lot if you could hit 5 stars and write a review and do whatever it is that you want to do. And it's all right, you can't send dirty pictures to the review, but you can write whatever you want. There you go. So this week's podcast is Declan McKenna. And I go way back with Declan McKenna to kind of the start of his career and also really the start of mine. A pal of mine sent me his song Brazil, which was a song he wrote about corruption in FIFA and the Brazilian World Cup. I think it came out quite a bit before the Brazilian World Cup. And, I mean, many artists write their first ever demo about corruption in FIFA. I instantly fell in love with his music right then. I was like, this is a very talented and smart dude. And if he's writing about stuff like this, I want to see where he goes next. It's definitely rare that like an artist like Declan fulfills so deep on that early hype and that early buzz. Because in the UK, we're so guilty of it. Like, the media here is awful. I can put myself in on that a little bit as well. Once somebody, like a new band comes along and releases something really exciting, the whole of the media just lands at their door expecting them to be the next Arctic Monkeys, the next Queens of the Stone Age, the next this, the next that. And it's kind of like a sort of unfair expectation to put on such a young person, but Declan most certainly has sort of fulfilled it. He's a very funny, very intelligent young dude. He's got a great attitude towards pop music, loving like ABBA and Vampire Weekend and David Bowie and all sorts of different things. He's never shirked away from the big topic in his songs as well, as I mentioned before, in Brazil. And a track of his called Paracetamol that I like quite a lot as well. And yeah, I think it would be fine for me to say, without hyperbole or over-exaggeration, that he may well one day be the king of everything. Here's a few bits of what we talked about on this week's podcast.
You know, I wrote some of those songs when I was 15. And it's like, I'm 19 now. So, you know, it's only 4 years, but it's a massive difference in who I am. And like, I don't know, everything I've been through is very different. And, you know, it's a difficult thing, but I'm writing. I mean, there's certain little scenes, but I just wish when I was sort of starting out, I had more sort of in my area where I had like bands and friends who were kind of doing stuff all together and making a sort of scene about it and having your own sort of identity that way that I've not found now. The problem with the music industry at the minute is people want shows near them. They want the show in the nearest possible town to them. And they also want new music all the time.
All the time.
And it, you know, you've got the label sort of asking like, oh, you got any new songs now? And it's like, do I? I don't know.
Okay, so this was recorded way back. This was like one of the first two or three podcasts. I recorded this the same time, around the same time as the Manic Street Preachers one that you heard first, and the Cribs one, which will be coming up in the next couple of weeks. But here we have it, this week's Slacker Podcast with Declan McKenna. 3, 2, 1.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, I give to you the delectable, the delightful, the darn right. I can't think of any other
yummy.
Yum. I was trying to go on the alliteration thing and just keep it all D.
The Declan-y.
The Declan-y, Declan McKenna.
Hi.
You like it?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe.
I'll take that. Or destructive. Dentist. The dentist, Declan McKenna.
The demon destructor dentist, Declan McKenna. I always harbored a want to be able to go into like UFC or boxing. Like, I have no real mad interest in either sport apart from like, you know, the drama that goes along with it. Like guys kicking the shit out of each other isn't really something I'm mad into. But I do like the guy that comes out at the very beginning and just goes, "It's time!"
I like how you went away from the mic there because I was getting pretty worried. I was getting quite scared that you were going to blow my head off.
It would be pretty shitty if I had deafened you.
Deafened me anymore. Mm. Protect your ears. We had a brief stint on Twitter about protecting ears.
Yes.
Ages ago.
You don't have tinnitus, do you?
A little bit. I do have a little bit. I try to protect my ears much better these days. Because when I was first touring, I kind of just had a really silly... poorly set up cheap kind of ear rig that meant that I just wanted to take them out all the time.
And some people find it very hard to sing with earplugs in as
well. Yeah, it can be. And I think when you're first starting out, you're just like, I'm young, I can get away with it. Yeah. But actually, you can't.
You can.
For that long.
I got tinnitus at like 20, 21. Mm. So like that's like nine, 10 years ago.
If you're overexposed to lots of loud music,
it's going to happen.
Probably going to happen, yeah.
And it sounds like...
I don't have a little...
But it doesn't go away. You know when you come away from a gig and you think, oh, that gig was great, oh, I can't sleep, but you're still sort of vibing out on the fact that you were there. Mm. You don't have one Converse shoe on because you were doing shooties, but the ringing will go away.
Yeah.
And sometimes it never does.
It's like a horror movie, except you just have an annoying sound in your ears.
I was trying to explain it to like my mom and my doctor when I first had it. And I was like, you ever watch Saving Private Ryan? You know, when like the guy gets his helmet and he jumps on top of the grenade and like everything just goes like really.
I associate it with like Call of Duty. Someone throws like a or something and then you just have.
Yeah, okay. If you listen to loud music all the time or go to gigs all the time, wear earplugs.
Yeah.
We're awfully socially conscious for.
Yeah, we've started off on a kind of infomercial.
We're up on our high horse already.
Yeah. I've never got down from mine.
No, exactly. You can't even get ladders that hit my high horse. What else should we tell people to do socially conscious? Like, protected sex. Make sure you look after one another.
Safe.
This seems to be falling into like a...
Stay on main roads. We learned this the other day. Here's another one.
Right.
Me and my good pal Will, who plays keys in my band, nearly got mugged the other day.
Shit, what, in London?
On the road we live on. Literally.
Oh my God.
It was fine.
What, like were they on a moped?
Just bikes, cycle bikes.
Yeah.
Young chance of kids came up like, grabbed Will, I kind of stepped past him, grabs Will and it's like, where's your phone, where's your wallet?
Oh my
and like
God.
Trying to grab it, Will just kind of like pushes him out of the way and then we just leg it down the road. But stay on main roads is the lesson that we learned from that when it's late at night.
I don't see the point in somebody stealing your phone now, because all the phones have got Find My iPhone on it. So therefore, like, when you steal it, you can go to the cops and go, look, it's this is it. If they turn it on, they'll know exactly where
it's
they
all,
are.
I mean, it's generally like someone...
And nobody carries money in their wallet anymore, are there?
No, not at all. I mean, people steal credit cards and use the contactless, but it's like, it's all...
You
can
get 20 or 30
quid like,
from that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. But someone was comparing it to like Oliver Twist, where you've got these young kids who are willing to like go out and try and rob people under the instruction of some other like sort of...
Yeah, like Maverick.
Sort of Maverick guy who like is quite nifty with that sort of thing, and like... They have to get a certain amount of phones. Like it's you know, you can think about it being
a
strange
operation. Do you
think
that the people that tried to monkey you were on a quota? They had to like get.
That's
ten,
what we were
ten,
saying. If that was the case, that would be very. Because
that would set them up for a job in sales very well. You know, like if you wanted to move off the streets and move out of crime, and into the real world of like you know legitimate gainful employment.
But then you've got this
targets is the key.
Then you've got kind of this, like, I don't know, this dodgy sort of communist dictator who kind of redistributes. If they've got a quota, they bring the phones back. And they only get a small percentage of the actual money. And whereas the guy at the top gets, like, I don't know. I've just sussed out something there, but
I mean,
probably not.
The whole thing is just so grim. It really is. This feels like it should be a topic for one of your songs. Like, you know, you're not, like, necessarily... The guy who writes, like, you know, the song about getting dumped or whatever, you've always got like a really big idea for a pop song.
And yeah, I just like songs that take a while to maybe figure out, I think. I've learned, and I like tunes that kind of have really massive, especially more recently on like the new stuff which I haven't even put out yet, like that I've sort of just been working on sporadically, like. It's all about sort of coming up with these really big ideas and like having a word that can mean so much without really being anything and has so many connotations. Just like being able to explore all those different things through words or through the sounds is just I find really fun. But also, you can say a lot of things you want to say with it as well.
It's a great thing about your style of music, because like pop music's not very layered. I've got a feeling, ooh, that tonight's gonna be a good... Like, I fucking despise the Black Eyed Peas, right?
I actually really wanted to see them. We were in Japan doing Summer Sonic, but then I found out Fergie wasn't gonna be there, and I was like, no one can replace... Like, obviously the rest of them are great, but, like, no one can replace
nobody
Fergie
can replace
in
Fergie.
That spot.
It's like Manchester United, nobody can replace Alex Ferguson. Nobody
Fergie
can.
Time.
It's Fergie
Where's it
time.
Gone now?
Exactly. If your name is Ferguson and you're in a job, you're irreplaceable. We're going to give some people like Thomas Ferguson and Barry St. Evans, who's listening to this, like a complex now. He's going to walk into his job tomorrow.
I'm Fergie.
And he's going to say, I'm Fergie. You can't sack me.
All right, guys, it's Fergie time. You're going to listen to my rules.
No, man, it's like, yeah, like I like the level of thought that goes into... Like, you know, how layered the song is, because obviously you listen to like pop music, and like, you know, you're not just like somebody who's like listening to music in 2017 or whatever. You go back through the ages. I saw, I think on Twitter, you said that you just found out "See Emily Play" wasn't written by David
wasn't
Bowie.
Written by David Bowie.
Yeah.
I
that's a Syd Barrett classic.
I know, and I don't know. It was one of those things I definitely heard both versions, but I think because Pinups, when I first was getting into Bowie, was an album that I listened to, I for some reason heard it as his song, and I can like hear the sort of classic Bowie with all the voices doing the sort of Cockney accent doing the "See Emily Play," and that was like almost that was the point of the song to me, was that sort of bit.
Yeah, you're like, oh,
and then it's like, oh yeah, the Pink Floyd version's really good too.
See, it's kind of embarrassing though when you get it wrong. At least you're like in the same ballpark. Did Bowie do Bowie? I can't say Bowie. It doesn't fit right with my accent. Did he do a cover off it?
On Pinups. It was on an album.
I didn't know that.
That's kind of why I thought he'd written it. But the good thing about when I tweet and post random stuff like that is that most of the people who are following me, who are a little bit younger as well, and kind of just have no idea what I'm on about, so they're like, what are you talking about?
At least they'll go research
so
it, and
just, yeah, and then
if one person gets into Pink Floyd from that, then brilliant. Right.
Have you listened to the demo yet?
Yeah, yeah, I listened to it last night.
Cool.
It's really good.
Yeah, it's actually one of the best demos I sort of made. It was like the last one I made for the album, really.
Yeah, it's... It...
And it took a long time to get to that, even that point. You know, there was an even earlier demo which just had the main part of the song without the extension. And there was also, way before that, I was on a train and I made that sort of end section. And while I was on the American tour in October, sort of November last year, spent the whole thing pretty much trying to piece together these two parts. Like, I know it works. I know
how
it
do
works,
I get
how
there?
How does it do it? That's like the first demo that, in some way, even though it doesn't quite piece them together the way it does in the record, it doesn't quite fit together. It was like, these are the two ideas I want to put
together.
Yeah,
exactly.
Like,
I will
how do I do
be
it?
Damned if I find a way.
I think it like changes key or something. I think it might go down a semitone or something ridiculous like that in this version.
Well, you've sent it to me under the title Humongous Extended Version.
Extended Edition, yeah.
Yeah. Do you the honours and introduce it?
This is an early demo of my song Humongous.
Don't take me along to your show, to your broadcast, I know. I'm good at letting go. Don't take me along to your rules, to your promise, I swear. Your phone and on your head. DK, I make you mind this enormous sense for it's not fair.
There we go. As we do every single time on the podcast, we play a demo. And that was Humongous.
Humongous.
It's the less humongous.
The less massive sounding, yeah.
Yeah, it's like a small humongous. Like a
little early humongous.
Yeah, like a very slim, slender, size zero humongous.
A bit humongous.
It's before it got to the album version.
How did you
go about turning that into what we hear on the debut record?
I mean, I wrote the bass of the song fairly quickly after listening to lots of ABBA, and obviously making it not sound like an ABBA song was kind of the first objective. But I wrote like the sort of two verses and the choruses. I went through two different verses, like styles that I was going to try. One ended up sounding like Mystery Jet's tune, and the other was the one that I ended up going with.
I mean, if you're writing contemporary guitar pop music, I mean, like ABBA and Mystery Jet are pretty good places to start, right?
Yeah, exactly. You got to start with your faves, I guess.
I used to turn my nose up at like ABBA and stuff when I was a kid, because my friend who was in my band, he used to write all the songs, and he used to like talk about how much ABBA were great, and I was like, what a loser. Like, ABBA, are you serious? That's what like my mum, even my mum wouldn't listen to that. And then like the older you get, you're like, actually,
it's just the songs are great. Tunes. Yeah. And it's not even like a surface level pop sort of thing, because like you listen to the records and they weren't just making singles, they were making amazing
records,
albums.
Yeah.
Especially towards the back end, the last two albums, even though they were all kind of falling out with each other and stuff. The songs are just brilliant, and you know, the albums are great start to finish, you know. And I think that for like one of the world's biggest pop bands that also had massive singles, every record they put out, you know, like I've got my record collection of ABBA is getting I've only got Voulez-Vous to get, but like you just look at the back of them, you're like, three or four of these songs you could still play at a party now. And then you're like, the rest of it's really ace too. Yeah, I think they're great, and they've sort of influenced me a lot.
There's a certain thing that about freshening in bands that I absolutely love. You know, when like you got your classics like your Fleetwood Macs and ABBAs, and obviously The Clash, Mick Jones and Joe Strummer didn't get on well all the way up to the Libertines. I just like it when a group fights, because I always think they create great art out of it. I always think that like in that sort of tension, the therapy that we get to enjoy.
Yeah, I mean, it can go one way or the other, really.
You don't really have anybody to fight with but yourself and all of the deep issues you've got in there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't have too many people to argue with over what I'm gonna do with the songs. You know, if I want to go a certain way artistically, I can. But yeah, it definitely can go one way or the other with bands fighting. They can just kind of end it, or there can be something really interesting about it. Yeah. But then, obviously, normally it ends up with the band finishing. In Fleetwood Mac's case, it didn't. And they kind of
just all slapped with each other, didn't they?
Yeah, they kind of just kept going after that. But in ABBA's case, after sort of The Visitors came out, they were kind of all sick of touring, all sick of each other.
But you can understand why.
But they made amazing records out of it, they did.
Bands fall out because there's, especially when you get to a successful level where there's money being made, right? There's percentage splits and some people are making more than others. But then put that tension into a bus for 18 months and send it around the world. And all those little things about how the bass player eats crisps, or how the drummer, you know, just has this like off-putting odor but not quite smelly. Do you know, like all those little things just start to get you, because it's almost like, you know, when you go home for Christmas and you're really happy for like the first week or whatever, and you're just like, oh, this is all amazing. And then you realize, like, you're going, oh, my sister's actually like, she's doing my head in.
Yeah.
But imagine putting that in a bus and having to like be together all the time.
Yeah, and feeling a bit gross.
Yeah.
And doing all the waking up early and going to bed late, and like doing loads of stuff that you don't really want to do. You kind of just.
Lots of foreign press.
Yeah, and like, you know, trying to get a point across, but also answering questions in which people want a certain type of answer, and it's just like it can be quite confusing, actually, the whole experience, and it will get on your nerves if you're the type of person to have that get on your nerves over time. It will, because you're doing loads of stuff you don't necessarily want to do. You just kind of want to write songs, as most bands put it, And then you've got all these people around you who are all, you could probably just be friends with. But after a while, it's like everyone has annoying things.
It's the same as anybody. Like, you know, you can't spend enough time with somebody without finding some reason to be pissed off. Do you know what I mean? If you spend enough time alone, you'll get reasons to be pissed off by yourself.
That's kind of the test, though, is whether you can kind of... I mean, obviously, I can't vouch for like a massive band like ABBA, who probably just got everyone asking for them and they've got everything to do.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that is definitely a test, is like seeing whether you can kind of not get on with someone one day and then kind of get on with work and like make up and just be fine about, you know, getting on each other's nerves every now and then.
what sort of kid were you in school? Were you like an introvert? Were you an extrovert? Were you like the sort of the music kid, or were you like jumping about and hanging out with your
mates? I was definitely a music kid to some extent.
Like when you're meant to be in one lesson, you're actually in the music rooms, like, slap bass.
I did, well, you know, I had guitar lessons every now and then. One time I had my Spanish teacher. The only times I would really be out of lessons was for guitar lessons, which you got a little slip to.
Yeah, I love that.
But once my Spanish teacher, who I don't know whether she liked me or not, or whether I was just a little shit in Spanish.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't good at it. but I left and for the lesson and didn't go, and she was really annoyed at me. And I was like, well,
and you almost give up music because of it.
I was like, that's it. No more guitar. I need to focus on my Spanish. But I ended up getting a D in Spanish, which is actually okay. Considering
it's all right. I got a D in French as well. My teacher hated me so much that when it came to the oral exam, everybody was allowed to use the dictionary except me and two other guys.
Oh, no.
Because he was just like, we were dicks, like,
yeah.
Absolute dicks. But I did a guitar lesson. I only ever did one. Like, I'm like self-taught bass player, but I did one guitar lesson. I turned up, and the guitar teacher like put the sort of tablature down in front of me. He taught me a couple of chords. I kind of half knew a few chords anyway from people showing me. But he tried to teach me "Kiss Me." Kiss me.
Right.
And I was just like, fuck that. I'm like, at that age, it was like, I'm turning up to learn The Trooper by Iron Maiden. I don't want to learn it in like 10 lessons.
Yeah.
I don't want to play.
You kind of
want to
be like all the kids in school who are just going.
Yeah, just the sweat. Like we used to call those kids the sweaties. Mm. The sweaty kids who would just be like riffing out. And like they're almost mathematical or scientific in the way they play
there
music.
There was some incredible like sort of mathematical or like classical inspired, you know, shredders in school. And we used to do these jam sessions. And I think... you know, there were a couple of years above me in school, and just these incredible guitarists that I've never really been able to match with, because I've always considered myself, you know, I'm more of a sort of songwriting, creative type than someone who can like drill all this guitar stuff. But I have been trying to get better at it. But just like even now, thinking about the kind of stuff that people could do aged, what, 15, 16,
you've got that or you don't. Like, I think like being a songwriter is probably more of a plus. Being able to play all of the instruments, like you do play all the instruments.
Yeah, I play a lot. And I've also been trying to learn more like piano and stuff like that recently, because guitar's always been my main one. But like, I've been trying to get better around the board. And being able to write on piano is like such a good tool.
I did see you congratulating yourself, going, well done. You've like majored middle C or something, or major C.
Yeah, I can play in C major, because it's basically all of the sort of... white keys do all of the chords for you, so it's like you basically can barely put a hand wrong, which is great. You know, playing in other keys where you're not sure where the hands go, I'm still improving at. But yeah, I've started writing songs on piano, and I think it's a really good tool.
It's one of those things that's very hard to master as well. Like almost when you start on piano, you can play. Isn't it? People say if you start on piano, you can play anything else, but it's hard to work into piano.
Yeah, it's. It's just so, because it's kind of, I don't know, it has the scale laid out on it in front of you. It's such a good tool for understanding music, like, and understanding how everything works, which is, even though I could kind of play guitar, not something I've started really, really understanding until now, even, you know, even struggling.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know, if I'd properly learnt piano when I was a bit younger, that probably would have been a good thing.
Do you feel like you get enough credit for playing all of the instruments, or most of the instruments on your album? Because, like, you know, when people talk about, I don't know, say Foo Fighters, right? Dave Grohl, like when he started Foo Fighters back in the early 90s, everybody's losing their shit. They're going, oh my God, Dave Grohl, not only does he play the drums on it, but he plays the guitar on it and the bass on it. But there's a lot more, more tracks and a lot more musical dexterity probably to the stuff that you do instead of just shredding out.
Well, I think half the people think that my band play on the record. I think a lot of people aren't aware that it's kind of a little bit more of a stem by stem kind of thing. Obviously, like on the record, my first record, I was kind of working with James Ford, who's an amazing drummer and
great
did a
hair.
Lot.
Great hair.
Amazing hair. Did a lot of the drum parts, the keys parts, but we kind of split, you know, the guitars, bass, keys sort of area and did all of that. But yeah, throughout, I've kind of wanted to, I don't know, play as much as I can. But I also, now I'm like moving forward and like learning about how my favorite artists made a load of songs. I'm like, oh, what if I had this amazing, like, you know, like players come into the studio and do all these amazing parts and kind of give them a rough sort of idea of what they're doing.
Horn and sections and stuff.
And just like, I don't know, attempted to do that. But I think for now, it's best to do it myself and actually give an impression of...
Yeah, I think you've got plenty of time to play with.
Do you know what I mean? Yeah.
Like, what artists do you... Or like, are you reading about? Are you finding out about?
I remember I was on a plane and I was watching the David Bowie Last 5 Years documentary where they talk to all the band. That played on the last two records, which both of the records I really love. And it kind of talks about a lot of the songs and how they made them. And, you know, Bowie would have the band play other parts and give them sometimes just a super vague sort of like... I remember for one of the songs, Where Are We Now, which was a single, he just told the drummer that he wanted the drums to be like, 1, 2, 3, 4... 1, 2, and that was the only description he gave.
Yeah.
And then, like, you know, from there, the drummer kind of is amazing.
Yeah,
and, like,
got
it and did his own sort of thing with it. And he has his idea for the song, but, like, kind of let all these amazing musicians kind of do their thing on it.
That's the great...
There's something quite amazing about that.
That's the great thing about, like, doing it the way that you do it, because you don't have anybody to argue with. This is your project, so you can go in and go, I'd really like it like this. I always, like... go back to the Some Kind of Monster DVD from Metallica, where you get to see in the studio how they record music and how they go about and what the dynamic's like. And there's an incredible bit in it where the drummer Lars Ulrich is shouting at Kirk Hammett, the guitarist. Like he's pretty much bleeding in the fingers, right? And he's like, "That's not the best solo the best guitarist in the world will play." And you're like, "Oh my God, is that literally how tense it is in the studio?"
I suppose when you're the biggest metal band in the world, it's like, I don't know, I think maybe there would be some kind of competitiveness like that, especially when you've had so many
metal's quite
massive records.
It's quite
stuff.
Like a teenage competitive, like, I can riff better than you can. But, like, it's also a very, like, I also think that...
It comes back to the sweaty thing.
The sweaty thing, yeah, big time. But, like, the metal fans are the most loyal fans that you will ever find.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they will support a band from the very beginning, and they will go to all the shows, and they will be there at the very end. I think, like, pop fans are almost a little bit more, like, not fickle, but, like, you know, there's so much more out there, and people kind
of
change their minds.
I suppose there's less of a scene about pop. You know, with metal, there's a scene, and you go to certain
it's
a metal
tribal
night, or you go to a certain thing, and you meet certain people, and you go to certain bars, and you know, you listen to certain bands, and it is a very specific scene that not everyone really is that into, or finds it easy to get into. So, like, when you got something like that, there is a real sense of identity that people will stick to.
It's just like, it's like religion. Do you know what I mean? People go to church. People go to the black church to play metal. What sort of, like, do you consider yourself to be a part of a scene? Do you consider there to be a scene in sort of the music that you make right now?
I kind of always say I wish there was a bit more of it. You know, I'm friends with bands, but it's all kind of feels like there's a bit of a club once you get to a certain point.
What, as in, like, the next level?
Yeah, it's like I mean, there's certain little scenes, but I just wish when I was sort of starting out, I had more sort of in my area where I had, like, bands and friends who were kind of doing stuff all together and making a sort of scene about it and having your own sort of identity that way that I've not found now.
You've had this fly solo, but I guess that the main problem is when you start as young as you did at 15, most of the people that would be your peers aren't ready. Because you started very early.
No, of course not.
Comparatively.
But also that's the thing, like, it's easy to do that. It's much easier now to be a solo artist than it is to be in a band, because you don't need to rely on anyone. You could be in your room on a laptop or whatever you've got, and, you know, the most, like, I don't know, handheld devices or whatever have a record setting that you can use and upload songs to SoundCloud, and that's how it all starts for a lot of people. And so you do it on your own, and it is very insular. And you meet people on the internet, and
have you ever collaborated with anybody online?
Because
I'm sure back when you were starting, like,
yeah,
you would be getting messages from people going, "Sup, bro, I got these sick bars."
Yeah, I did. I met a couple of people. I don't know, I think I did a couple of, like, theme tunes and, like, stuff for little short films that people were doing.
That's
when
cool.
I was first
starting
out. I did, a couple of little things like that. But, like, I don't know, I didn't collaborate much. I've been writing a bit more with, like, my friends and stuff recently.
Do people, like, because you're on a major label, mm-hmm. you're on Columbia, one of the biggest labels and one of the best labels about, surely there must be a pressure where people are going, "Declan, we'd really love you to do a songwriting workshop with such and such, either for you or for them." Do you know what I mean?
I think in conversation with like your label or whatever, that sort of thing comes up. But I think I started from absolutely nothing.
Ground zero.
Doing everything on my own. And it's like, got to kind of, you know, being able to do this all the time now.
Yeah.
On my own. Like, obviously collaborating with a certain level of people, but in the songwriting process, like, you know, 10 out of 11 songs on the last record were just ones I'd written in my room or whatever. And so it's just like, you know, for now it's not broke. So,
so keep it going. Phil Tiger. Okay, so we're about halfway through this week's podcast. We need to rehydrate. Need to eat one of those like little disgusting power bars that have absolutely no bad things in them and taste like shite. And get ready for the second half. Dust ourselves down. Maybe put a new jersey on. As you can probably tell by this stage, I really enjoyed chatting to Declan. Kind of chatting about everything and absolutely nothing at the same time. He's a fascinating fella. And, you know, that's only going to get better the older he gets, like, musically, anyway. I've seen on his Twitter that he's working really hard on his second album, and he said that it's 100% coming next year. His words, not mine. I don't want any of Declan's fan base coming to me at, like, the 31st of December 2019. "P-Tag, you said the album was coming." Like, no, it's Declan's words. Also, guess what? I've got to do my first... I say I've got to. Like, I'm being, like, held at gunpoint. I'm doing my first Slacker podcast live on November the 9th at BBC Introducing Live Festival at the Tobacco Dock in London. And I'm doing it with a band called You, Me at Six. I'm sure there's a lot of Declan McKenna fans who like You, Me at Six as well. And it's really exciting. Like, not even just doing the live podcast, but, like, the whole three-day festival that BBC Introducing are putting on. It's mad. It's designed for, like, the next generation of young artists and bands. So, like, they're saying there's going to be about 15,000 people over the 3 days attending, and there's going to be workshops and panels and seminars and loads of gigs as well. So basically, if you, like, want the knowledge and you're releasing music, or you're even just thinking about starting to write music, that's kind of the place you need to go. Also, bring your demo down. You know the way, like, I've had Declan playing his demo and Wolf Alice playing theirs? Well, if you bring your own demo down to this as well, and you sign up the right way, it's all up on the BBC Introducing website, you can get your demo heard by, like, I'll be there, I'll be listening to the demos, there'll be loads of other DJs and people listening to demos too, so come down. You can get tickets as well. Just type in BBC Introducing Live Festival, and I'm sure you'll find tickets online somewhere. Also, if you've got any ideas for who we should get on the podcast... I've got some really special ones coming up, by the way. And a lot of ones have come out of the woodwork since we started as well. Get in contact at Philly Taggart on Twitter and Instagram. Okay, right, enough of the plugs, blah, 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 blah. Let's jump back into the podcast now with Declan McKenna.
Hello.
The one track I think you're making reference to is the one you wrote with Rostam, who used to be in Vampire Weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I thought that's a perfect relationship because he, like, I assume, right? I might assume wrong, but you're a Vampire Weekend fan, right?
Yeah. But I've, like, especially when I was a bit younger, obviously I haven't put out a record in a while, but, like, gotcha. I'm so into them.
Ezra,
like,
needs to get off the radio and back on recording music, I reckon.
Yeah, but I think apparently he said, like, the album's 80% done or something like that. I think they just, I don't know, probably taking it. They're one of those bands that can kind of take with their time. I'd rather hear a good Vampire Weekend record
than just throw out
one that they just put out, so.
But working with Rostam like that, it's the final track on the album, record. Yeah. It's weird, right? Because, like, you expect, like, if you see it on paper, like Declan McKenna and Rostam, I'm expecting this kind of, like, Vampire Weekend cross section of weird timing and like obtuse angular sounds
and marimbas and
stuff. Then when it gets into it almost like drifts into like a country-esque way, you know, when it like sort of breaks into it about a minute or two in, I'm like, that's a country melody. Fuck did that come from?
it was a strange one. It kind of started like I'd never co-written before, like, never.
That's a weird process anyway.
And I basically like turned up at Rostam's sort of like home studio and it was just like I was meeting him for the first time and we were like working something and he'd probably tell you now that I was so insanely awkward and a lot younger than I am now. Like when I sort of saw him the other week when he was playing in London, it's like, yeah, how young I was. I was 17, but like...
What are you now, 19, 20?
I'm 19.
Yeah.
I've just turned 19, but I'm...
You've had to grow up fast.
But also just like, I don't know, I was still very much like a young teenager then. And, like, I was super awkward and, I don't know, the process took a little while. But, once we kind of got into it, it was really fun. And it took, I had to kind of go home and write the lyrics. Because, again, I was really awkward with, like, putting out lyrics before it was, like, the perfect idea. I was really worried about saying something bad. And it's like, why would you do that when you're writing with someone? You want to get out as many ideas as possible. But he kind of turned to me and was like, do you like classical music? And I was like, Yeah. And he just started playing the cello part, which is basically the bit that's in it now. And we added the kind of Stonesy drums, and it all kind of built up just on a screen, like track by track. And then we had a slight melody with the sort of little guitar part I did, and he did a cool little funky bass line. And I don't know, it was a weird one because it just kind of built and built. And I wrote a couple of lines there and then took it home for like months. Until the next time I came out to America and we finished it when I came back. I kind of did.
And it's a banger.
I really like the song.
Yeah, closed the record. I could see you working with him again, right?
For sure. I think he's just the kind of person who's really great with working other people. And you can tell why that's kind of something that he's really good at when you're working with him. He's very good with getting ideas out of people. Very good at just writing songs and creating stuff that's really interesting and fun.
Are you starting to think about recording and writing again now?
I'm writing a lot.
Like, I mean, the album only came out last year.
Yeah.
Like, it still feels fresh. Like, I hate this thing, and it's a very, very British media thing, right? The British media is insanely fast on music, right? Mm-hmm. As in, like, they will try and break a band when they've just put a snotter on a microphone. But then when it comes to albums, they're like, okay, so that album's done, where's the next one? And people really want stuff way too soon, and have no real time for the process. So, like, I don't really want to go, have you got a second album done yet? Because I know for a fact that, like, it takes a long time to make.
Yeah, especially the second album, if it does much better than you're expecting it to in terms of the amount of people who listen to it and, you know, still are, it's like, well, I don't want to do something worse, but at the same time I feel much more confident in my songwriting and I think I've improved.
Yeah,
but it's like, it's gonna be a different thing. I'm much older than, you know, I wrote some of those songs when I was 15. And it's like, I'm 19 now, so you know, it's only 4 years, but it's a massive difference in who I am. And like, I don't know, everything I've been through is very different. And you know, it's a difficult thing, but I'm writing and I'm getting some really cool ideas out. It's, yeah, but that is kind of the problem a problem with the music industry at the minute is people want shows near them. They want the show in the nearest possible town to them, and they also want new music all the time.
All the time.
And you know, you've got the label sort of asking, like, oh, you got any new songs now? And it's like, do I? I don't know. I don't know what I can give, what I can't. It's
see, I can't give off that bad about it, because I run a record label as well. and sometimes I have to catch myself on when I'm like talking to like one of the artists or whatever that I work with. I'm like, oh, can you give me some new songs? And then I'm like, oh shit, I've turned into that guy. And also, they're actually really busy.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, that's like somebody coming to me going, hey, could you hurry up and finish this book? Could you do this podcast? Do you do this, that, and the other? I'm just like, no, I just have anxiety pangs, do you know?
That's the thing, is like, you have to dedicate so much time to writing, but actually when you think about it, like, not that many artists make that much money from selling records anymore, so you're basically writing an album so you can go out and tour and be able to live off that so you can pay to make the next record. And it's like, I'm spending all this time writing basically so I can spend loads of time touring, and it's just, it's a very confusing thing. And when you haven't written on the road before, it takes a long time to get into it, and I'm getting better at it, but now we're about to go on a 2-month tour in America in a van. Sort of like 9-seater splitter van all around the US, and it's like, album 2, when's that gonna happen?
Yeah, exactly. How do you even go about writing in a van? Like,
you don't.
What are you?
I did a B-side. The B-side that was on the Isambard vinyl was a track called Midwest, and I did that in a van going around the US. And like, it was only a vinyl release that probably 200 people have heard if they bothered to listen to the B-side. But I did that, but it was an instrumental track that was just super weird and kind of went from like this Radiohead thing into this sort of super strange upbeat electro thing. And it's like, that was the kind of thing I was confined to making. I couldn't really sing or do a guitar take or like, you know, get anything like that. But at the same time, I spend a lot of time finishing songs. You know, you sit on your laptop and you piece things together, but that does really kill the writing process. It's not fun. It makes it really not fun sitting on a laptop and messing around with the parts in a song.
See, some people love that. Some people like being able to zone out and do that. Maybe it's not for you. I want to bring up the bit about Jules Holland, right? But not the same bit that I'm sure you've talked about lots and lots and lots, right? This is I'm talking about when Declan went on to Jules Holland. And if you're unfamiliar with Jules Holland, he's this sort of legend in the UK music industry, who's been running the show for like 300,000 years, where he gets like the best live act on in one room. Yeah, exactly. 300,001. And he gets the best act on sort of in a circle. And you would go from somebody like new, like Declan McKenna, to Kings of Leon to Barry Gibb or whatever. But when you were on, you were like, right, I'm going to make a statement. So you wore the t-shirt that said,
give 17-year-olds the vote.
Yeah. But my favorite bit about that, when I watched it back again, because I was just sitting at home with my missus, and we were both like going, go on, Declan, yes, this is great, brilliant. Somebody's fucking with the system a little bit. And but my favorite thing was how awkward it was to get your guitar off and your jacket off, because you were like, obviously, I really want to get this t-shirt out there. I want to get this statement out there. And you're like trying to get your guitar off, and you're like, crap, my statement, this is my big moment.
Yeah, it's funny. It's one of those things, it's like you can plan it out in your head for months before, but when it comes down to doing it on live TV, it's like you either do it or you don't. And I managed to do it fairly successfully.
Yeah,
you know,
it looked good.
I haven't heard many people point that out, so I never even really noticed that.
I thought it was funny, because like, I'd imagine in your head you like, pictured it like Hulk Hogan.
Yeah. The only thing I can ever pick out when I listen back to that one is the mix, because I'm like, my guitar's so loud. I've got such a quiet guitar part in that song. I'm like, my guitar's so loud, I can't hear the keyboards. But like, it's just like one of those things where it's like the levels kind of change in the song, and we have like a, you know, all these different things happening which kind of change, and it's like never going to be the way you want it on TV, really.
Who was with you? Who was playing?
Because it's not the same exact same band I have now.
No, like, slightly who different. Else was like playing Jules Holland that night?
Yeah, well, we had right next to us, we had Slaves, and it was Wiley, I think.
Yeah.
Lisa Hannigan.
Yeah.
Nora Jones, Barry Gibb.
Oh, what a lineup.
It was wicked.
Did anybody come up to you directly after, like, you did that?
I kind of...
And we're like,
I kind of,
what did Barry Gibb say?
Well, I kind of shook hands with Barry Gibb while we were getting a picture and stuff, but I didn't quite... quite get to the chat with him I would have liked. But yeah. I kind of shook hands with Slaves. It was quite funny. They were like, yeah, it was super punk, man. We kind of went to our punk game.
You, sort of punk band. You out-punked the punk band?
Out-punked the punk band. Yeah, they were still fairly punky. But I was like, you know, I think I was more that TV show punked than punk.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you're sitcom punk.
Just like a little punk that all the guys back home are shaking their fists.
Yeah, exactly. The man, the man is sitting watching the TV, and he's like, "Oh,
you rotten kids!
You damn rotten kids! Get out and stop scrumping my apples!"
I find it so funny. Like, there are so many like sort of internet dads or whatever who will really come out at you on social media.
Shit,
man,
like given like middle-aged men.
They're
the most bitter trolls online as well. Like,
oh yeah,
because they've got a lifetime full of angst, and you know, like kids have had social media for a long time and have learned how to sort of like you know monitor it. But like, you know, that the angry dad or whatever, shit's not going his way. That like, you know, the divorce is going badly or whatever, has just logged on to Twitter for the first time and he's just realized nobody has to see my face. I can give off.
In the same breath, there's a lot of quite encouraging sort of dad types on the internet as well. It's sort of
reliving their youth.
You're like, oh, you're proper man. You're like, you know, oh, this is like music I used to listen to, or like something like that, which is may or may not be true.
Do you suffer much from trolls? Do you suffer because like you've got like a pretty hefty, I'd say, a size 10 of an internet footprint, social media footprint.
You know, you get it, but like you learn to just not bother with that. I mean, I just spend my time on Twitter, which I've tried to minimize now because I've realized it's just silly to spend all the time that I used to spend on the internet.
Yeah.
But I just spend it trolling anyway. You know, I'll just tweet out just the most random bullshit.
You're a friendly troll. Like, you're an easy.
No, I don't bully people.
No, but like you're like almost like you're trolling yourself or trolling.
Yeah.
Like ideas.
Yeah, you're exactly.
A mixture between like eccentric and like a little bit of like
self-deprecating,
but also the kind of like the smart-ass kid as well.
Yeah, I'm all of those. I try and be all of those things, but yeah, I don't know. It's a weird world, the internet, all the different sort of characters that come out.
Yeah. Do you think that? And it's, like, yeah, I'm just generally interested. Do you think that like people who are 17, 18, 19 year olds now are having it more difficult socially to interact with each other because social media has been literally in their life for the whole time? Because it wasn't in mine, like Facebook and whatever. I didn't get a Facebook till I was like 16, 17.
Yeah.
Like we were on Bebo beforehand, but it was only something you just kind of did as a bit of a laugh. Do you know what I mean?
I've been lucky to spend the last couple of years like interacting with so many different people because like, you know, using the internet so much, you do actually kind of not learn properly how to interact with people.
Yeah,
like, I think people do lack certain social skills, and it is quite worrying, you know, like, they'll grow up talking to people online, we'll have 10 minutes to think about what you're going to say, and then you kind of meet certain people who are young, and it's just, they've just been kind of, I don't know, told to use the internet all the time, but also now kind of struggle to converse properly. Like, you know, in a normal scenario.
That idea of like a teenager being, you know, sort of stuck in a room is age old. Like that's not just a social media thing. Like,
of course,
you know,
yeah.
Like ever since comic books or just like, you know, you could listen to music in your room or watch TV in your room. Teenagers like will always want to recluse. Like they'll want to go into their own space and create their own space and stay in their own space.
Of course, but conversation has been changed.
Because you're on your phone, like I sound like such an old man, but like, you're always there now. Do you know what I mean? You're always there. Like it's the social
it's
media.
It's not even when you're in your room. It's when you're out and about. You're not really looking or talking to people. Like, and I do that.
I'm really bad for it. Like I'm really bad for like sitting on my phone and chatting to someone. I actually remember the first time we met. You were on your phone like the whole time.
Was I? Probably.
But you were like quite young and like sort of like quite new to like. The music industry.
I had a really bad phone when I first met you.
I definitely
didn't have like a smartphone
phone?
Or anything.
I thought you said a bad vibe. I was like,
no. Yeah, no. I just thought you were a dick.
Yeah.
I think I had one of those old like sort of Samsungs that's kind of touchscreen. It didn't really work properly.
Yeah. And yeah, one of little those. Cracked screen and stuff.
But I probably was, because that's kind of just what you do. But I've got much better now, but I still do it.
I mean, you were getting courted by record labels and music industry people.
I was just sick of talking to people.
Yeah, exactly, man. Like, exactly. Like,
where did I first meet you?
You get that same... I think I found your song and played it on the radio when it was Brazil.
I think you called
early
did
days.
You not call
yeah,
me?
I called you up because I was like, this song is fucking sick. And I just started a record label around about that time as well.
Yeah.
And I was just like, oh my God. And yeah, like, I love this song, it's so good. But you know that when we played that song for the first time, I was like, I was really happy, right? Because I love finding new music and I love finding new artists and I love finding like artists I really love and can't wait to share with everybody. So I was just like really happy about it, and I told like a couple of my friends that I was going to play this great song, and I played it to them before I played it on the radio. Radio in general has been pretty good to you.
The kind of weird thing is, like, although Radio 1 was kind of my first big radio slot, bar, you know, some weird little ones, it took a while for anyone to really listen to me over here, whereas the radio in like America... Like, Brazil was like an alternative hit, and it
That's
was just
right,
like
yeah.
so strange. Such a strange thing. It got to like 15 in the alternative chart.
That's insane.
Which is just like unbelievable. I did this whole, that was kind of why I left school initially when I was 16. So I had this whole like month long radio promo tour around America before anyone cared. I think it was just after I'd played the Barfly while it was still
which
the Barfly.
Which is a small venue, yeah.
In London. And I was going out and, like, you know, promoting this song on all the radio stations, all the sort of alternative stations in America, and it was...
So I'm writing a little book at the moment about the music industry, and I'm getting tips from lots of different people, and I want to get a tip from you, something you would say to someone who's starting out in music. And it doesn't, like, you know, it can be pretty much anything. It doesn't have to be like, you know, practice hard. It could be factual, or, you know, you can go with it whatever you want.
That's interesting. I've had a lot of good advice actually that I could kind of share. Most of it revolves around stealing things in the right way. Like 90%, if you get advice from like a band who are doing well, they're just kind of... What it boils down to is steal things in the right way. Steal things you love and steal it well.
Do you mean like steal things from a writer or steal things from music?
From music, both? Yeah. from songs you love, from albums you love. Just whether it's a sound or whether it's a... It's like, you know, being able to use what you know and actively thinking about you using it. Because also, if you know what you're using, you know not to make it sound too much like that. And then you create something that's actually your own. And I think stealing in the right way is quite a good thing. And also, you know, if you're at a venue and they've got a table which you could do within your rig, it's like...
Perfect. But like, artists have made careers like actively ripping off artists that they love. I mean, we wouldn't have Oasis or Noel Gallagher without... T-Rex or John Lennon or the Beatles or the Sex Pistols, and they're very open about ripping off maybe the Kinks or somebody like that.
Yeah, of course, that's what everyone does, and it's not that you're, you know, there's
you're not a thief. You're
passing it on, because you're never going to come up with some original idea without taking in some kind of influence. And it's like, I think the more you write as well, the more you have to acknowledge it. When I first started out writing tunes, it was like I'd spend so much time thinking about ideas, but now you almost speed up that process by being like, right, what do I want to get influenced by? What do I want to listen to? And create something like... But then obviously doing your own thing with it and like making it new and making it a modern thing is like a big part of that process. But yeah, it's like, it's all about stealing the right things.
What's the most obvious lift for you that you've like nicked off somebody or put on...
My lads,
is this gonna like create a lawsuit?
There's certain like throwbacks on the album. I think one that gets pointed out every now and then, although, you know, it's not the same.
Actually, I've got one. I can just remember one right now. Brazil sounds a little bit like Gautier, somebody that you used to know.
Yeah, that was definitely not something I thought of at the time of writing it. But I understand. There's a bit where the xylophone comes in.
And it's descending.
Yeah,
isn't it? But that's the only bit
in the bridge. Yeah, I've heard that. I don't know. It wasn't really something I thought of at the time. The one I was gonna sort of mention is like at the end of Humongous, the bit I basically made separately from Humongous, actually before I even wrote the song, just on a train from either London to Paris or Paris to London. I was just kind of on the train on my laptop.
Yeah.
And I was like, I want to make a little thing that's a bit like Ashes to Ashes. And I made something that was a bit like Ashes to Ashes.
Happy days.
But that also brings us back to that demo, because
the demo that we heard at the very beginning
is like that sort of little session that I did on my laptop, and also some of the parts that I used on the original, in the like main part of the song. That's like one of the only songs where I actually used stuff in that demo on the record and actually like transferred it to the actual thing, which is quite fun. Phil Tiger.
Thank you so much to Declan. Thank you to his manager Tara as well for their time and hanging out with me in that small fetish dungeon studio that we've got in. So I need to stop really calling it that. People are gonna not want to turn up to the studio if I keep calling it that. Maybe I'll not call it that from next week. I wish him all the best with the second album. I don't think he needs any help with it. I'm sure it's going to be incredible. I am heading back to the old country this week. I'm heading back to Ireland as I'm putting the finishing touches. Well, almost finishing touches. I'm getting there. Anyway, I've written 18 of 20 chapters of this book that I've been writing for 2 years. And, oh my God, writing a book is the biggest ball ache that you'll ever do in your whole life. But I've been getting to that point where I'm getting excited about it again. Like, I think when you do a big project that takes 2 years, sometimes you're just thinking, is this worth it? And now I'm at the point where I'm like, this is really worth it. I can't wait. But I'm going to tell you all about the book and what's in it and all the rest of it. And it revolves around Slacker, put it like that, in the next coming weeks. And you'll probably be wishing that you've never heard about the book. Next week we have a fella called Dylan Mills on the podcast that you may know a little bit better through his stage name, which is Dizzy Rascal. And that podcast has some really explosive bits, and I'm really proud of that one. Lots of love to the Slacker team, Jenny, Adam, Chris, Barney and Sam, and I will see you next week for a podcast with Dizzy Rascal.